Women knitting can and have changed the world.
So there have been all these ways that women have used their handwork to give us voice. And that was another really important thing for me to trace. And I felt a kind of conflicted way against this. There's a way that women's handwork is marginalized because women do it and because often older women do it. So there's a sort of, it's little old ladies sitting on the porch rocking kind of thing, which on one hand I want to say, well, no, it's not. People of all ages and all genders knit. But also I want to say, so what if it is?
That's Peggy Orenstein. We talk about what she learned about life while shearing sheep, dyeing wool, and making the world's ugliest sweater. Her book is Unraveling. But first, Katie Simpson-Smith tells us about her new novel, The Weeds. It weaves history, botany, feminism, and the climate crisis together into a compelling and sharply funny tale. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In The Weeds by Katie Simpson-Smith, two women, one from today's Mississippi and another from Italy in 1854, navigate the Roman Colosseum, documenting the plants they find there for their respective employers. Through a list of seemingly minor plants and their uses, medical, agricultural, culinary, these women calculate intangible threats, a changing climate, the cost of knowledge, and the ways repeated violence can upend women's lives. They must forge their own small acts of defiance to redefine the roles women are given and the lives they make for themselves. Katie Simpson-Smith is the author of four novels and one book of historical fiction. Katie Simpson-Smith, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
This is a very, in many ways, very different novel than your other novels. And I'd love to first just give our listeners a little taste of the writing because it verges on prose poetry often, and it's quite beautiful. Do you have the book there with you?
I do. Let me just grab it real quick. Yes.
I wonder if you could just read from page 4. It's the entry for Anemone hortensis, or star anemone. First, just set us up a little bit.
Sure. So this novel follows the lives of two different women, one in 1854 and one in 2018, both of whom have the sort of unenviable job of cataloging all the species of plants that are growing in the Roman Colosseum. So they're both assistants to male botanists who exert their power in various unpleasant ways. But these are the women who are actually on the stones of the Colosseum looking for all the species that are growing in the cracks and in the subterranean spaces and up on the top of the stones. So this excerpt is from the 1854 narrator. Anemone hortensis, star anemone. Rome without you is muffled. A wash of absence coats the stones. You thought my grief would swallow me, but lover, I have taken an apprenticeship in color. I mark down what grows, making notes so a man in a waistcoat can make a green and ordered story. Deacon claims to hold the keys to me. Not in 4 decades, he says, has someone combed for every plant in this great bowl. Not since Napoleon put on his hat again and fled from Elba. I'd flee from here, but every other place I'd turn, my home, your bed, is barren. The Colosseum continues its crumble. The vines continue their sprawl. The truth, I don't flee because you might return. Give me your faraway hand. Let me put its soft skin here on this anemone, stamens and anthers of uncommon blue. Blue as oceans, as lapis paint, as the base of the horizon in heat, an early bloom. I inscribe a letter on the backs of 16 petals. Love, forsake me not. There is no petal for the comma, so I leave it out. In the 10 days since you left, my breath works to fill the new hole. But I must have a man's conviction. Like Napoleon, you'll sail back. The ancients thought anemones wouldn't open unless the wind blew.
I love the way that ends. The plants are such a character here as well as the characters. But first, tell us about this character. Tell us about the person she's referring to. And also tell us about the botanist Deacon, who was a real person.
Yes. So this narrator has fallen in love with a woman at a time in history where that was not an easy thing to do necessarily. Her family is certainly not supportive. And when they discover that she has been sneaking out at night, not only to meet this lover, but also to engage in small thefts from the community, her father decides to apprentice her to Richard Deacon, an English botanist, as a kind of punishment. He thinks that she can be controlled and her wildness sort of tamed if she is pursuing the hard labor of science. So Richard Deacon is a man who has come to Rome to do this botanical work of cataloging species. And he is a sort of classic Englishman. He is sort of portly and blind to certain things around him and a little bit of a colonialist attitude. And here is this young female apprentice in his care who is still just brokenhearted about the fact that not only has she been separated from her lover, but her lover has married a man and has sailed away from Rome. So she is feeling all the melancholy of those emotions while also suffering against the kind of constraints that Deacon is placing her under.
And now tell us about the other narrator.
Yes, so she is writing in 2018. She has come to Rome as a graduate student, so under a more kind of traditional form of apprenticeship. She has a graduate advisor who is directing her thesis, and she's doing what many science grad students do, which is the unthanked work of data collection. So her advisor is a man who is engaged in the sort of larger ideas of science, and she is simply tasked with seeing whether and how many species from Richard Deacon's original 1854 list still exist in the Colosseum. If they're still there, she puts a check mark by them. If she can't find the species, she marks it out. And so she is starting to have large ideas about climate change and what it means that so many plants are missing. But her advisor is not giving her the space to express those larger ideas. And she also is coming from a place of, I would call it rage. She lost her mother at a young age. She has been sort of tossed about by men in unfortunate ways. And she's just very angry about having to do these sort of menial labors and not getting to really express who she is as a person.
Yes, I think a lot of women reading the book will find many notes of sympathy with her attitude. I mean, she is clearly in a white-hot rage, and it was just kind of glorious to be able to read that, because so often the rage of women is really silenced, and it's outright out front and center in this book. Talk a little bit about writing that rage. What did you feel like you had to strike a balance, or how did you make it, you know, authentic in the book without, I don't want to say too much, but without becoming unbalanced?
That's such a good question. I never worried about what balance to strike, partially because I myself was writing from a place of rage at the time. I wrote this in a kind of flurry in the fall of 2018, which was sort of the height of the Me Too movement. It was when the confirmation hearings were going on for Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. And we were having all of these women come forward with these horrific stories, and none of them seemed like they were being listened to. And so I found in these women a kind of mirror of the women in the news, the women around me, the women of my own experience, who are flailing and attempting to speak truth to power and really making no headway whatsoever. And so in my head, I thought, okay, I'm just going to write this all exactly the way I'm feeling, which is, you know, very upset with the conditions that women are experiencing in this country. And then I'll go back and revise and sort of tone things down if needed. But when I went back to the text after sort of letting it sit for a while, I realized that in some ways it felt like the truest thing I had ever written. And so I thought, you know, this isn't my job to rein these characters in. It's my job to let them be who they need to be on the page and then leave it up to the reader whether to connect or not.
Well, and also it's very funny. I mean, it's liberating.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, I really had to laugh out loud, although there's a lot that's also sad in the book. But I want to go back to the flowers now, because they are the other. Well, there is actually another character. There is one ghostly male character. And tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, so the woman from 1854 alternates with the woman from 2018. And then occasionally you get one other voice appearing, describing these plant species, and that is a ghost who is floating above the Colosseum, observing these women, having very negative and nasty opinions about what they're doing. And part of the work of the book is trying to figure out whose ghost it is and what happened to him to cause his demise.
So now the plants. I mean, for one thing, well, I learned so much about plants. You got so into the weeds. Maybe there's a double entendre here. Got into the weeds about the plants here in this novel, The Weeds, Katie Simpson Smith. What moved you to take up that?
Part of it was the kind of close attention necessary. I wanted to write about something that is largely unnoticed. And I think the world of science has always been a very rich field for me in terms of inspirations. And when I ran across a mention of this original flora of the Colosseum that Deakin had written in the mid-19th century, my mother was actually the one who told me about it. And she said, did you know that there was this document in the 1850s that said that there were 420 species of plants growing in the Colosseum? And immediately I thought, that can't be possible. The Colosseum is such a sort of sanitized space now. And then my second thought was, that sounds like the structure of a novel. 420 species of plants. What kind of story could they tell? So I knew that I wanted to mimic the same structure of that flora and sort of go species by species, paying attention to each one, to what each plant said in terms of its position in the Colosseum, its position in terms of this changing climate, its past, its culinary and medical uses. And by paying such close attention to plants, inadvertently, I began making an argument about the kind of attention that needs to be paid to women. So all these parallels popped up between weeds and women, their unwantedness, the ways that they thrive in the harshest conditions, that they sort of insist on their own presence, despite people trying to eradicate them. And so the closer I got to these tiny little plants, the closer I felt I was getting to the truth of these female narrators' experience as well.
And you know, the climate aspect of it was very interesting to me. I mean, as my listeners know, it's one of my obsessions is what's going on with the climate. And what's been interesting to me is to see how much, I mean, I've been working on that issue since 2004 when nobody was, you know, very few people, even people I normally respect, didn't believe in quote unquote climate change. And now everyone is talking about it. I'm noticing how much it has crept into books that aren't climate fiction per se. It is the constant background to our lives. And I just wanted to get your perspective on that and how you why you incorporated that into this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right that there's been a kind of surge in not only climate fiction, but just fiction that is taking the environment more seriously, just at the most basic level, because it is a huge form of drama in our lives right now. If, you know, writers are searching for conflict and fear and uncertainty, there's no better place to turn than the environment. And I think there's something about grappling with the natural world that embeds characters in their realities in a way that feels not only authentic, but really necessary. And it seems like, especially in a book about science and in a book about nature, to ignore the realities of climate change would be pretty foolhardy. And I think for these characters in particular, what makes climate change so significant in their lives is that it is once again something that is so drastic as to necessitate a kind of fury and rage, and yet still is coming across as invisible to large swaths of the population, the same way violence against women is. So I think certainly my contemporary narrator saw that as something that was sort of intimate to what she too was experiencing.
Yeah. And so talk about the different way that these women actually relate to the plants versus the way the men that they are working for relate to the plants.
Yeah. So both of these women come to plants with a lot of feelings, and the men that they're working for are coming from this sort of classic scientific background of observation and facts. And we make notes of what we see and we describe the outlines of these structures, but we don't imbue them with any kind of emotion, certainly with no sort of anthropomorphic qualities. We just observe and come up with hypotheses. But these women, first the 19th century woman who is seeing these plants as sort of echoes of her lost lover, as opportunities for communication with that lover, as symbols of what she has lost, it's impossible for her to divorce them from the feelings they evoke in her. And then the contemporary narrator sees them as these weedy trash plants that no one cares about, just like no one cares about her. And she gets very invested in them and realizes that it's human feelings around natural environments that is the only possible catalyst for improvements when it comes to climate change. If we don't feel anything about plants, then we're not going to be, you know, in any position to save them. So she is the one sort of most vocally trying to fight with her advisor about how valuable emotion can be in science. And he finds as many ways as he can to reject that idea.
And also that's a reflection also, not just of the power imbalance between him and her, but also in a way he relates to plants as a way of dominion. You know, they further his career. The facts are not something that is, there's a purpose to the facts, and the purpose all relates to his needs.
Exactly. You know, to getting tenure, to advancing in the field. There's a point at which the contemporary narrator is floating this idea about a similar flora that she could do in Mississippi, which is where she's from. Jackson has a Colosseum as well, which is very different from the Roman Colosseum, but she has this idea that she could catalog those species, and it would be a kind of cultural project as well as a scientific project. And her advisor just shoots that down immediately and says, you know, there's nothing worthy of study in Jackson, Mississippi, essentially. We're doing this work in the Colosseum because it's been done many times before. We're part of this long tradition of scientists who are studying a well-known place. And she sees that as so misguided, that it's eliminating the space for discovery and for newness, and also for bringing people into the scientific community that have not been allowed in for centuries.
And there's also a wonderful quote. She says that strange we should call, I think it's her, strange we should call leaves heart-shaped rather than admitting that so many hearts are leaf-shaped. I loved that. that twist of perspective that we really all need to have.
Yeah, Yeah, and it's so much of science has tried to ignore, I think.
Exactly. And when I say need to have, it's, you know, there's another book I'm reading called The Myth of Human Supremacy, and I think the title says it all.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the structure of the book. You know, these two voices are very close together, yet they are not differentiated in any of the traditional ways, you know, that authors do. In fact, the narrators themselves are not even named. It took me a while to figure out who was who and how the book was structured. And so this was quite bold on your part. And I think it works, but the reader has to work at this novel. So tell us a little bit about your thinking around that.
Yeah, so I had these two narrators in mind. I knew that they were going to be working on the same text, this Flora from Richard Deacon. One would be doing the actual job of writing it in its original form, and the other would be doing the work of responding to it. And so I thought a little bit about, you know, alternate ways to structure it, where perhaps the first half of the book is just told from the past narrator, and then we move into the present narrator in the second half of the book. But as soon as I started writing their voices, they clearly, to me, seem to be talking to each other. There isn't a kind of separation between their experiences. They're woven together. They are encountering so many similar things. They're echoing each other in a kind of call and response. And so very quickly, I thought, okay, these women have to be alternating evenly throughout the book. And I knew that that was risky because, you know, they aren't named, and it is disorienting at first to try to figure out who is the speaker. But there is one thing that I gained from that is that towards the end of the book, as they become almost more closely entwined, their experiences start bleeding together even more, and you get the sense of collapsed time, which is very important to me, that there isn't a kind of progression of history, but that history is sort of cycling over itself continually. And so I loved having those moments, especially towards the end of the book, where you're thinking, is this one thing happening to both women? Are these women, you know, one is becoming bolder, one is becoming a little bit more muted. They're feeding into each other's development in a way that felt very necessary for me as a writer.
Could you say a little bit more about collapsed time and circularity? In other words, you're saying not so much spiral or progression. Where does that come from? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was thinking, you know, about this, the experience of the woman in the past, who in some ways we might see as being more oppressed than the present day woman. Her same-sex relationship is not condoned in the way that it might be today. She is extremely limited in her movements as a woman, especially as a young single woman. So we think, okay, she definitely has it worse off. But then we get to the present narrator, and there are so many new ways of being silenced and being trivialized that we realize it's not just that things have gotten better over time, but that the ways in which women are treated simply morph from one sort of strategy to another strategy. So I wanted to sort of get rid of the idea that women's lot has necessarily improved, but then also to show how the framework of the plants themselves, which are ever-changing and responding to not only climate fluctuations, but also, you know, tourist patterns and architectural decisions, that this is undergirding the two women's experience in very similar ways. And the more you see the women as participants in the same kind of system, the more they start speaking to each other. And I've just always loved the idea that the things in the past are not really dead, that we're constantly being informed by those choices, by those personalities, and that in many ways they're living around us still.
And you were a historian. You were a scholar or have been a scholar of gender. Your first book was We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835. So it's very interesting to hear you as a historian. I mean, is this what motivates you about history, the dialogue between the living and the past?
Oh, yeah. I think the reason I got into history to begin with was a sort of love of storytelling and an attachment to these stories from centuries ago that have always felt so vibrant to me still. And so I loved doing research for that book and for my doctorate degree. It was a way to sort of inject real people into these, you know, textbooks that I had read, you know, growing up in middle school and high school that were always so deadly dull, but I knew that there was something meatier within those, you know, timelines that we were forced to memorize. So graduate school was this fabulous time of discovering stories and humans and finding those parallels with my experiences today that really led to this feeling of sort of circularity in time. And so when I started writing fiction, that was a way to combine what I love best about research and about finding actual archival materials to sort of bolster one's understanding of the past, but also using the imagination as a way to push those stories into a more sort of three-dimensional and emotional realm than traditional history usually allows.
Well, it's a wonderfully alchemical combination that you put in this novel, The Weeds. Katie Simpson Smith, it's been just great to talk with you about it.
Oh, thank you so much, Francesca. It's always a pleasure.
Katie Simpson Smith. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or read an excerpt from The Weeds. You can also find our other interviews with Smith about her three previous novels. Next up, Making a Sweater from Scratch, and I mean scratch, and What It Taught Peggy Ornstein. Stay tuned after the break. If You Love Me from The Mountain Starry Singers. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. When the COVID pandemic lockdown upended Peggy Ornstein's life, she figured she needed something compelling to do. So, of course, she decided to learn one of the most difficult skills there is, shearing sheep. That's because, as a lifelong knitter, she thought it would be great fun to make a sweater from scratch, from shearing to carding the wool to dyeing it and finally knitting it. Along the way, she learned a lot of other things, too, like the environmental impact of fleece and, even worse, its artificial alternative, how women's handwork has changed the world, colonialism and color, and much, much more. Ornstein shares her findings in her new book, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. Peggy Ornstein is the author of numerous books, including Girls and Sex, Boys and Sex, and Cinderella Ate My Daughter. Peggy Ornstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just loved reading this book, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. I actually disagree with you on that last one.
Yeah, I have thoughts about that. I'm happy to illuminate.
Now, you begin the book with a quote from Wendell Berry, who's one of my favorite authors. You say, the quote is, "It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work." Why did you choose that quote?
You know, I have to tell you, you're the first person to ask me that. I really appreciate that. You know, because I started this book during lockdown when I was, you know, every life had ground to a complete halt. And we were lucky, my husband, my daughter and I, that we were, you know, able to, you know, we were solvent. We weren't essential workers. We could stay home. We stayed well. But it was this moment of everything grinding to a halt where my work stopped. And also, so there was that and thinking, what am I going to do with myself now? And deciding to, you know, what I was going to do was explore the idea of what it meant to make a garment from scratch. But it was also that this moment in my life, as a midlife woman, who's my, you know, my daughter, was filling out her college applications during that year. My husband was retiring. It felt like a lot was changing. A lot of the things that I felt were really solid and like I'd gotten it all together, you know, were just kind of falling apart. So I think it's at those moments that we really find out who we are and what we need to do and be.
Yeah, so life was unraveling for a lot of us. But you are a lifelong knitter, which involves raveling.
Which, by the way, is a word that means its own opposite. Raveling also means unraveling.
I didn't know that.
It's a contronym. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have been a lifelong knitter. And during the pandemic, of course, as you just said, you decided to make a sweater from scratch. You sheared the sheep for the wool. You carded it. You spun it. You dyed it. You knitted it. Why a sweater rather than, let's say, well, I guess it might have been pretty hard to make a cotton shirt from scratch.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. Well, because I'm a knitter. And so I sit during lockdown, knitting was one of the few things that made me feel calm and grounded. And I'm also a journalist and curious. So I also have always kind of, as I, you know, feel my fiber running through my fingers, thought, gee, yarn, who thought of that? You know, who thought of taking two sticks and doing, you know, like I have these questions about how things happen. And I wondered what it would be like and what I would learn. And then also, I think for me, as for a lot of women, and it's because very much about women, women's lives, women's work, women's connections. A lot of us learn from our mom. And I have an acronym that I kind of jokingly keep repeating in the book. It's a little awkward, but it's SFHLM, which is she learned from her mom. Because every time I would meet somebody and talk to them, I'd say, how'd you learn? And they go, oh, I learned from my mom, or maybe I learned from my grandma. I mean, sometimes now they learn from YouTube, but mostly it's moms and grandmas. And it's this sort of generational connection. And during lockdown, I found myself sitting and knitting and talking to my mom. But the thing was, my mom had been dead for 4 years at that point. So I was still, you know, kind of talking to her in my head and having these conversations that I'd kind of wished that I'd have with her about what her life was really, you know, what I really wanted at that moment was to sit and knit with my mom, connect with her, but for her to be my age and for me to be that age as well. And so I thought a lot as I went through this process about what I learned from my mom, what I didn't learn from my mom, what I wish I'd learned from my mom, what I wish I hadn't learned from my mom. And then as the mother of a daughter who was launching into the world, all those questions relating to her too. So at one point when I'm designing the sweater, I run kind of smack into my body image issues that my mom sort of, you know, inculcated into me, much as it's painful for me to say that. And I think a lot about how I tried to stop that, the things that I didn't. And I never taught my own daughter to knit because I knit in a weird way. And I thought, you know, I wanted somebody to teach her so she would learn properly and correctly. And I thought, you know, there's a whole category of things that we don't want our daughters to learn from us too. So all these things sort of came into play while I was doing this.
Your body image issue. Say a little bit more about that.
Oh, well, you know, I was anorexic as a teenager. And I mean, I've spent my career writing about girls and women and issues that we confront often in the body. My previous books were about sexuality, about the impact of media on bodies and body image for little girls. My book, Schoolgirls, my first book, was very much about those issues and how they affected our self-image and our ability to function in the world. So it's been a lifelong thing that I've been writing about and thinking about. And what I wrote in this book, which is probably something I wouldn't have written until after my mom had died, about sort of our relationship around body image issues and how, you know, when I was a teenager and I started putting on weight, she thought it was kind of, I mean, and it's hard for me even to say it, frankly, Francesca. I mean, I feel like it's so hard to say something, you know, that puts our mothers in a bad light. I love my mother. And so much was wonderful about her, but this was one of the things that was hard. And she would do things like, you know, try on my jeans to show that you know they were big on her and how sort of her own body image issues about reinforcing her own thinness, and that was not a great thing to do to your 15-year-old, you know, and sort of just thinking about how the through line with women and how we think about body image and how that then even affects something like how I design a random sweater that I'm making for a book about going from sheep to sweater.
Yes. And, you know, of course, human beings have their flaws. Nobody's perfect. And you really do highlight another aspect of what your mother taught you in terms of knitting. And that is that knitting was almost the basis of human civilization. You call it the unseen weapon that allowed the human race to conquer the earth.
Yeah, well, that's string, really. The string revolution, that's Elizabeth Wayland Barber. That we don't think about, you know, I mean, there's so many ways that I learned to think about textile and fiber and cloth that just had never entered my consciousness. Things like, you know, why don't we think about our clothing the way we think about our food? You know, so many of us are so conscious of the environmental impact of our food, of eating fresh, healthy, organic, of how our food is produced, of who is producing it, and the ethics of the labor and all of that. And then that just shuts down when we come to clothing, even though the fashion industry is one of the worst offenders in terms of climate change on the planet. And so that was sort of a big area of interest in thinking about that. And then the other piece was just like, and so much of our lives involve textile and fiber. You know, when we come into this world, the first thing that happens is we're wrapped in cloth. And when we leave this world, the last thing that happens is we're wrapped in cloth. And in between, we spend a whole lot of our time, you know, wrapped in cloth. And we think so little about it. And I had thought so little about it until I started this project. And it was one of the, you know, every book is a braid. And the piece of the braid that I knew, and it's not just a three-part braid, it's like a multi-part braid, at least to me. And the first piece was this, I'm going to go out, shear a sheep, process fleece, spin it into yarn, learn how to use natural dyes, and make a sweater. But I didn't know, the pieces that I didn't know were things like, you know, learning about the planetary impact of our fashion, learning about the importance of women's work and the radical feminist history of women's work and in fiber, learning about the impact of dye and color, all that I learned, talked about in terms of my own life. And I knew I'd talk about my mom, but my father at the time was in his mid-90s and had dementia and was in a facility in Minneapolis where we couldn't go because of lockdown. And, you know, all of that, like all the things that you don't know when you walk into a project are the things that are just sort of amazing, surprising, fun, and enriching.
And really made this book wonderfully informative and fun to read. You know, as you say, the braiding together of your own personal life along with, I mean, the incredible experience of how you learn these basic skills, which we're going to get into now, but also all the other, as you've just said, how clothing shapes civilization, class, culture, and power, as well as the environment. So let's start at the beginning here. Oh my God, learning how to shear a sheep. Wow. I mean, I just kept on thinking, you're a better woman than I, Gunga Din. I don't know if I could ever do that. Tell us a little bit, Elise, about that and Martha.
I mean, honestly, I think I was just naive. I never would have done it.
You know, we're such an urban culture. We don't really know what it means to do these tasks anymore. So I was kind of like, sure, I can do it. Sign me up. Even though people were saying, you know, it takes calorie for calorie. It burns more calories than twice as many as marathon running and takes tremendous upper body strength. And I was just like, yeah, sure. I'm, you know, pushing 60, no problem. But it was really, really hard. And I mean, I always like to say the first thing is sheep need to be shorn. There's like a sort of narrative that it somehow is harmful to the sheep or something. No, they will die if you don't shear them. They will become unable because we've bred them to just keep growing this fleece. So eventually they become unable to eat. Their lambs can't suckle. They can flip over and drown in their stomach juices. I mean, horrible things happen if they're not shorn. So it must be done. And it doesn't hurt them, but they don't love it. It's kind of like, you know, if you give a toddler a haircut, has to be done, but they don't love it. It doesn't hurt them. And except that the sheep are covered with this waxy substance called lanolin that's very slippery. And they have hooves and you have a hot whirring blade with no safety that you're using. So I cannot even begin to emphasize how physically difficult that task was. The woman I was learning from a young woman who's about half my age, she could do it in 3 minutes. It took me an hour and a half to shear a sheep and I sheared three of them. But it was also exhilarating and exciting. And my final sheep that I did the best job in and whose fleece I used was named Martha. And so I feel every time I look at my sweater or as I was making it, I would feel a very deep bond with Martha and feel like I had to do her proud with whatever I was doing. Everything I did when I was learning to dye, when I was learning to spin, I would not immediately do it on her fleece because I wanted whatever I was doing, my skill to be Martha worthy.
Martha worthy. I love that.
Yeah.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Peggy Orenstein about her latest book, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. So now take us to the next step, carding and spinning the wool. Tell us about that and also just about a little bit about what you learned.
So first you have to, you know, wash all the gunk out of the fleece and clean it somewhat. It's got a lot of barn in it, you know, and then you have to card, which is you take these sort of two things that are like dog brushes, if you know what dog hair brushes, and put a little tiny bit of fleece on and you go, you know, kind of back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then you have to roll it into a sort of cigar shaped puff. And it took me about 10 minutes to do one of those. And you need to make, I read somewhere, 579 of them to make a sweater. So that part took, you know, forever. And one of the things about, I mean, that tended to be done by small children in olden days and they did it faster. But one of the things that was a gift with these tasks, again, at that time it was lockdown. My dad was in a facility in Minneapolis. He had dementia and doing that slow, you know, I was always trying to, I wanted to be a good daughter. You know, I was flying into Minneapolis whenever I could. I would call him, but I was always sort of also, you know, you had to gear yourself up because he couldn't hear well. He didn't connect very well. It was painful for me, you know, to talk to him. And doing this slow task, I would sit with him on FaceTime and just sort of be. And he would watch. There were Twins games on that were, you know, reruns where the Twins always won. And he would watch those and I would sit with my carding. And when I look back on that now, it gave me this time with him, this slow time. To just be together and not be thinking about other things, that now that he's gone, he died last fall. It just feels like such a gift. I just treasure that time. So that's one of the things the project gave me. And then with spinning, I loved spinning. That was really fun and meditative and lovely. Women spun constantly in ancient times. You know, I mean, all the time because they had to make cloth. So they were just, there's some theory that the Venus de Milo, the position of her shoulders indicates that before her arms fell off, that she might've been spinning. And I mean, everybody did it. It didn't matter if you were a goddess or a queen or a peasant or anywhere in between, you spun all the time. And so a lot of creation myths that are not the Judeo-Christian ones revolve around women spinning or weaving. So the Greek myths, for instance, the three fates visit babies when they're born. And the first one, whose name is, not to put too fine a point on it, but Clotho, is the youngest, and she spins the filament of your life. The next one who's the matron, measures its length, and the crone, who is in some ways the most powerful, snips it to indicate the end of your life. And to me, it felt so obvious that women and women's textile production should be the central metaphor of creation myth, because, you know, what could be more divine than creating something from nothing, whether you're creating, you know, fiber from fleece or bread from wheat or human beings from nothing at all. You know, it just, it clicked something into place for me that was beautiful. So whether I was writing about creation myths or fairy tales, because those were developed as women sat and spun and were bored and, you know, didn't have the internet, so they had to make up stories. It just was so central to women's lives and work and connection for hundreds of years.
Yeah, so you mentioned the word fleece. Talk a little bit about what's happened and is happening to the wool industry. It's being supplanted by fake fleece, which is a horror show.
Right. I did it when I went to the ranch where I sheared Martha was a regenerative ranch. So it kind of did sustainability one better. It was actually improving the soil and the air and the water with its farming practices. And I wore my fleece there, what I thought of as my fleece, which was, you know, made of recycled water bottles. It is not a fleece. And it was kind of the equivalent of waving a ham and cheese sandwich on a white bread at a bar mitzvah. You know, it was like, because even if you use those, you know, the recycled water, it's still going to end up in landfill, right, eventually. And also, in the meantime, it's shedding microfibers, these little teeny weeny filaments all over everything, which have become the biggest threat to the ocean, one of the biggest threats to the ocean and waterways, these teeny tiny plastic, non-biodegradable fibers that come off of these recycled water bottle or otherwise synthetic garments that we wear. And in our lifetime, the thing that has really changed, which, you know, I kind of had a sense that fast fashion was bad kind of thing, but I, you know, not really, didn't really get it. And in our lifetime, we used to wear mostly natural fibers. And there's some good things about synthetic fibers, obviously, but they now comprise 70% of what we wear. And they're made of plastic. So they do not biodegrade. They just go into landfill and stack up, mostly in the global south, where they're called dead white men's clothes. And even if you think you're giving them away to Goodwill or anything, that's where they're going to end up. So that's a huge problem. And then the other thing is the churn. That it used to be that clothing, when we were younger, a new line would come out maybe a couple times a year, three times a year, you'd get new clothes for school, whatever. But now people get new clothing, you know, once a week, and they're putting new clothing out, all made of plastic, all using dubious labor practices, hundreds or even thousands of items a week up online on these fast fashion purveyors. So the amount of clothing, the cheapness of the clothing, the labor practices, the what it's made out of is all creating one of the worst catastrophes in terms of climate change, which, you know, for me, probably for a lot of your listeners, you know, here I am, I'm like trying to buy organic and I'm driving my Prius and I'm recycling and I'm doing, you know, and I was like, oh my God, my clothing, you know, and I kind of felt like I just want to buy, you know, I just want to buy my pants. I just want to buy a pair of pants. Do I have to, you know, but it's so important that we know. And also I think for those of us, particularly who are makers and who value what it means to, you know, what our materials are made of and the time and effort and love we put into our work, we're in a unique position to lead the charge in terms of a more regulatory push, a legislative push to regulate an international industry that is, you know, inordinately profitable and has virtually no regulation on it whatsoever. And we really can make a change in this realm. So it's actually kind of hopeful and important to know about what's going on.
Yes. In New York State right now, there is a proposed Fashion Act, some of us in the climate movement are working on.
Yeah, that's one of the main things to support the efforts in Europe. There's some really big change afoot, and we have to educate ourselves so that we know to get behind it.
And which this book, Peggy Orenstein, Unraveling, really does do, and in such an engaging manner as well. So we've talked about shearing and carding and spinning. Dyeing was also just fascinating. You go into kind of the class aspect of color as it was historically, and you made your own, you grew your own dye plants. Tell us about the dyeing process and what you learned. And that's D-Y-E-I-N-G.
Yes, it is. you know, there was a point where I thought, I'm just going to write a book about color. You know, this is, it was the coolest thing ever, whether it was the ways that, you know, as you said, fortunes rose and fell on color. The Spanish Empire was in a large part built on the color red. They discovered a bug in Central America that made a really bright, durable red. And they brought it back and they did not know, they didn't tell anybody what it was. So nobody knew it was a bug. And for 200 years, they kept that secret. And that thing, you know, it was just worth its weight in gold. And pirates would be hijacking the ships and people were trying to figure out what it was. And meanwhile, over here, you had blue, which historically people didn't even see blue, which blew me away. But the Homer describes the sea as wine red and the sky as bronze, because ancient people did not, they just didn't care. It just wasn't an important color to them. So they just didn't note it. It was there, but they didn't care. They knew red, they knew, you know, whatever, but they didn't care about blue, which is so hard to grasp. But anyway, blue finally came along. It became popular. It started being imported. It started threatening red, the merchants of red. And they would do these crazy things, like the merchants of red would bribe stained glass makers so that they would make the stained glass in churches. They would make the devils and the hellfire blue so that people would associate blue with hell and not like it and not wear it. So it was like, you know, it was like crazy stuff. And then by the 19th century, along comes this guy who was kind of like the Steve Jobs of his time. And in his room at home on spring break from college, basically, he's doing a chemistry experiment and his test tube is dirty. So he wipes it. And on the cloth, there's this pinkish purplish stuff that won't come off. And it's coal tar derived. And that was the first chemical dye. And from that, every color in the room you're sitting in right now was derived. And within 20 years, all the history, all the lore, all the knowledge and recipes for natural dye virtually disappeared. And I read, I learned about that. And I thought, it's just like this time we're living in now where technology has made it so, you know, whether it's taxi cabs or now it seems like my career, you know, writing with chatbot or, you know, democracy, you know, all these things are like, boom, things that we thought were eternal, gone. And it's a very similar, I mean, history repeating itself and how we react and adapt in the face of change is the only constant is really what we have to take away from that.
Yeah, it's a real unraveling. And in fact, I've often thought of, you know, if for some reason, you know, for some reason we lost our technology, we would be worse off than people hundreds and thousands of years ago.
Yeah, because we know how to do nothing. It's funny that you said that because I write about this in the book that at one point I said, you know, a friend of mine sort of jokes, well, now you have something that's going to let you into the last safe city during the zombie apocalypse. You have a skill, so make sure you throw some food over the wall for the rest of us. And there was a lot of apocalyptic talk around this when I said I was doing it because it was during the thick of the pandemic. And my husband said, well, that's ridiculous. And I went so far, I actually thought, I'm going to download instructions and print them out for how to make a spinning wheel. Because what if we lose all, you know, the internet and all electricity? Like, I better know how to do this. And my husband just looked at me and said, there's stores full of clothes. There's going to be clothes for decades. That's not going to be a useful skill. Learn how to do herbalism if you want to do something useful. And I thought, oh, well, okay. But I did have that thought. What if we lose it all? I need to have a skill that's going to, you know, nobody's going to let the 60-year-old woman writer into the bunker. I need something better than that.
Well, let's go back to color, though, because I wanted to talk a little more about blue. And I love this. You write that blue is a spirit, a rhythm, a melody, a relationship, a concept. Blue is also a trick.
Yeah. Blue, I mean, for me, writing about blue was, yeah, I just don't feel with other colors. They have the same soul and they sort of affect us in the same way. And the way, you know, there's so many metaphors around blue and so many ways that we look at our life. And I talk about sort of all the shades of blue that I feel around me when I look at my mother's, or when I think about my mom's death, or when I think about my daughter leaving home, or you know, happy blues, sad blues. But blue also is very rare in nature. And that's why I think people, you know, didn't perceive it or didn't name it until really pretty far after other colors got names in many cultures, not just in Greek, but in, you know, everything, Lakota, in Asia, in Japan, in ancient Arabic. There are no words for blue in those languages. And things that we think of as blue are often a trick of light. Like if you look at a peacock's feathers, if you look at it closely, they're actually gray brown, but it's the way that light reflects off them that makes them a bright blue. That's true of the sky and the ocean as well. So there's very few blue, you know, flowers. There's not blue food. And our blue eyes too. Our blue eyes are not blue. I have blue eyes. They're actually light brown. And it's the way that light reflects on them that makes us think that they're blue. So blue is a very tricky color. It's magic. And making blue is equally magic. The process of making blue is different than any other dye, and it requires a kind of chemistry. I mean, I thought of it as magic because the chemical aspect of it was a little bit beyond me, including that when you dip something into your blue vat that you finally made and you pull it out, it comes out green. And then before your eyes, it morphs, it alchemizes into blue. And it is one of the most astonishing chemical reactions I've ever seen. It's just beautiful.
So now let's talk about the knitting. And you reference Madame Defarge from Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. Now, I remember reading that when I was in high school, and it was like one of my favorite books. And Madame Defarge was my favorite character because, you know, as you say, women have long used handicraft as a way to act in the world, just as she did. She was encoding revolutionary messages into her knitting. So talk about this connection between knitting and action.
Yeah. I mean, she's complicated, right? Because she's both a hero and a villain in kind of equal measure. I love Madame Defarge. But all the way through history, women have used handwork, and I look at knitting in particular, obviously, as a way to have political voice, particularly when they were not allowed political voice, whether that was patriotic or whether that was a voice of dissent. And so, you know, if you look at World War I was a great example in terms of the patriotism. Soldiers were dying in droves in the European theater. The 75,000 British troops and 10,000 American troops died of trench foot, which was essentially wet feet, and they would get gangrenous and then they'd die. And it was a completely preventable thing. They just needed to have socks, but they couldn't make socks fast enough to equip them with dry socks. So, you know, knitters to the rescue, everybody who could was knitting up a storm and making millions of socks for the troops. And, you know, I'm not saying that necessarily that we won the war because of women's knitting, but I don't know that we could have won the war without it. Women have used their handwork as cover for spying activity. In contemporary times, our knitting has become even more radical, where people have done things like make temperature scarves to keep track of the changes in climate. Or I wrote an article, an editorial about this for the New York Times when the book came out, about women, the radical nature of women's handwork and how it has always been a kind of act of political dissent. And the weekend that it ran, somebody wrote to me to tell me that they had just gone to the group of women had made a gigantic crocheted piece that was like the size of a building with Lady Liberty with her torch. But instead of a torch, it was a uterus. And it was a statement about reproductive rights. And they had gone to the New York State Legislature and unrolled it on the wall of the legislature, from the gallery in the legislature, to support reproductive rights and protest the constraint on reproductive rights that's happening right now. So there have been all these ways that women have used their handwork to give us voice. And that was another really important thing for me to trace, because, and I felt a kind of conflicted way against this. There's a way that women's handwork is marginalized because women do it and because often older women do it. So there's a sort of, it's little old ladies sitting on the porch rocking kind of thing, which on one hand, I want to say, well, no, it's not. People of all ages and all genders knit. But also, I want to say, so what if it is, right? I mean, older women, whether they're sitting on a porch or making a podcast, we have a lot of power. We have a lot of say. We have a lot of voice. We have a lot of energy. And we have done a lot of political work. So please do not marginalize me. That's just ageism and sexism.
Right on.
Yeah, right? I mean, it really, you know, I really wanted to make this point that it was both and, because what happens is, and I've heard from a lot of people who knit about, you know, saying like, thank you for that, because the narrative is either, well, no, it's lots of other people, which continues to marginalize, deny, and stigmatize older women, or it's older women are irrelevant, which continues to marginalize, stigmatize, you know, older women. So either way, we're getting kind of shunted to the side. And I don't want to do that, even as I want to make the point that there's a broad range of people who are engaged in handcraft.
And right there, you just put it all together, as you do in this wonderful book, Unraveling. I mean, beautifully written, engagingly written, I have to say. I mean, I just loved it from start to finish. Thank you so much, Peggy Orenstein, for talking with us about Unraveling.
This was great fun. Thank you for having me.
Peggy Orenstein. Read or listen to an excerpt from Unraveling by going to writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk about Ram Dass with Amy Butens, and we also travel to Shangri-La with Jane Marshall. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.